Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Blown up, Ace, Dice, and Giants. I'm Tom Howell, and we're on the board. S&P futures up 25. Nasdaq futures up 137. Who knows? You might actually get a bounce today after a few days in a row of no bounce. So we could use an up day here in a lot of stuff. We could use it in Bitcoin and a few other places where people are, I think that the S&P or the Nasdaq's been down, I'm going to say, pushing 5% in the last 3 days. So that's kind of a lot. Tesla's been getting its ass kicked. It's under $1 trillion in market cap. I don't know how that makes me feel. I think I do know, but I'm not going to say it. Anyway, do we have Mr. Kevin?
Good morning.
How are you, bud?
Oh, I'm doing all right.
Kind of a gloomy day here. It's raining, but at least it's not snow. But kind of gloomy.
Yeah, we may be past the worst of that. It's not like it never snows, past late February. But usually when it does, it comes and then it goes away pretty quickly. And kind of the same bite is not in the air that was in the air a couple of weeks ago. So I would say we're starting to turn a corner on winter.
And we would, if we get 0 days in March, that's like really, really unusual. So hopefully.
Oh, yeah, we can even get them in April. But, like I said, if it snows, it'll be a real pain. And we might even get, a pretty decent snowfall, 5-6 inches. And then 3 days later, it'll all be melting.
Well, you sound a little like Ralph Cramden, easy come, easy go. When I had it, I went with it. You needed some, you got yours. Remember? When he had money the one time, then he didn't.
Yeah.
Easy come, easy. But nobody could quite say.
I'll also go with Bang Zoom, but okay.
Yeah. No, nobody could quite say a one-liner like Jackie Gleason, huh?
Well, he was fantastic.
I kind of thought, although he was nowhere near as talented in terms of, he was, Jackie Gleason was a big band leader too. Terrific,
yeah, I didn't know that.
He has. You can go on YouTube, and some of the stuff he does is unbelievable. With all his music writing and all that stuff. And anyway, I thought our generation guy was going to be John Belushi, but that didn't work out so well, did it?
Well, it could have been John Belushi if he had lived long enough. But like many incredibly talented people who have tremendous success quickly and in large quantities, he burned it out, he flamed out. We've seen so many of those, and it's not just it's not just our generation, it's generations before us.
Well, you went a lot slower if it was just booze. I mean, you didn't have a whole lot of guys, the people in Hollywood in the 30s and 40s, there wasn't, at least that I know, there wasn't the kind of drugs involved. A lot of them drank to excess, shall we say.
Yeah, I think there were more drugs than we know, but than we're typically, because it wasn't so it wasn't so ingrained in the culture at large, so it was kept under wraps. But yeah, Judy Garland would be an example of an absolutely incredible talent.
Yep.
Who flamed out on alcohol, died younger than she should, and really, as a performer, she never sounded bad, even in her later years, but you could tell that, that as you saw her, that she just was not in good health.
A lot of the younger stars, I think the studios fed them a lot of speed to get them going.
Yeah.
The more of the Mickey Rooneys of the world and the Judy Garlands, those people. the child, Elizabeth Taylor. I think the people who were that were the child actor stuff. It was pretty nasty what the studios did to him, but I mean, it wasn't recreational heroin, you know, like Belushi and those guys were into. But when you think about it, I mean, Belushi, John Candy, who's the other guy, the other heavy set guy?
Well, Chris Farley.
Chris Farley.
Did Chris Farley die because of drug use? I know that alcoholism was part of it, and it was, you know, it was part of his family in general. It was, you know,
well, if you're
out of it in there,
you know,
but
if you're 150 pounds overweight and you're, you're losing
his weight, his weight didn't help his cause either.
No, but I mean, yeah, and you're, but I think those people, when I talk to young people today about how much people used to drink, now when you go out on a Friday night or Thursday night, even go to the bar downstairs. I mean, our group liked to tip a beer for sure, but the shot after shot after shot where you go out and you get absolutely obliterated. I don't recall us ever doing that. I mean, nobody went to the infirmary. I mean, people were hungover for sure, but
And also now it's combining them with energy drinks.
Yeah, well, and the young people, they'll do that, but on a daily basis. The amount of people used to drink when I first entered the business world was like something you wouldn't believe. I mean, it was, two, three drinks at lunch, you know, everything, dinner. And I mean, it was, you go to dinner with some of these guys, it was like, you know, my first business trip, Wally Kilray said to me, "Now, you're a pretty big guy, you're an Irish guy, I imagine you drink." Well, yeah, you don't drink like these guys, so just be careful. What can you drink all night? And, doesn't bother you. I said, well, I can just, you know, like Canadian Club and water or something. Fine. The minute you think like you're losing it just a hair, go to the men's room, pour half foot out, fill the rest up with water, because you're not going to keep up with these guys. Don't even try. He says, but every time a drink is ordered, you got to order one. Otherwise, they'll look at you weird. We're just a different world. We're talking four or five drinks before dinner, wine with dinner, a couple after dinner drinks. And the next morning, you meet these guys in the office, it's like they went out and worked out all night. They're sober as a judge. You talk about practice. But you don't see people drinking like that anymore at lunch and stuff.
But we're talking about practice, not a game.
Yeah. you know, drinking is like everything else. It takes practice, but you don't really want to do that to yourself. Hey, in another installment of stock ownership last night, I stopped up at the... Actually, I stopped up to see some of the Marquette game because I couldn't get it on my thing. But there's this guy that I know from the hood. A very successful guy. I mean, like real successful. Loves to gamble. He's a funnier than hell to talk to. He owns a bunch of recycling places. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can talk to him about steel all night long and what you do with this kind of stuff and what you do with there and how much it is per pound. Because at Pullman, I was... did a lot of work when they used to sell all their trace stainless steel and aluminum. I did some work with that, so I know a little bit about, very little bit about metal salvage and so forth. But anyway, and the guy's got a portfolio, and you know you could be the referee on this because I'll never win this argument, like no matter what. But a quick story: when I thought I might want to get involved in the trading business, my cousin knew a guy named Larry Carroll. And Larry Carroll, I'm sure most people over the age of 50 have heard of C&D Commodities. Rich Dennis, who was a huge trader and money manager, actually commodity pool guy, which is different than a hedge fund, but they're called commodity pools. And, you know, we could do that because we're a futures firm, but we haven't done one in a while. Anyway, so he takes me around the Board of Trade floor. You know, I'm in my suit and stuff. You know, I was like... some interviewee, nobody else has a suit, I don't look like a dork. And the guy is telling me about how he was position limit long in beans and corn or something. I think it was corn. And corn's trading like, you know, 320 or something. And he had bought it at about 180 when nobody wanted it. It was flat on its ass. But the dude has 3 million bushels of it. I mean, he's position limit in this stuff. So, of course, it's down like 8 cents, and he's not real happy. And I said to him something to the effect of, well, you know, you're still up like $1.40. He looked at me and he said, don't ever think like that. Don't ever be a retail trader. You're better than that. I'm down today. It was 320 last night. Now it's 309. I'm down 9 cents times 3 million. How much is that? So don't ever say you're still up. You're down today. And I have this conversation with, and then when I 20 years on the trading floor, 21, if I bought, you know, IBM at 100, and it went out at 100, and the next day it went out at 99, I lost a buck. I mean, there's no question. You mark yourself to market every day. Yet, a lot of retail, now obviously if you buy a house, you don't do that. Or if you buy a car, you don't do that. You might, every once in a while, I want to think, gee, I bought this antique car for 40 grand. If I had to sell it today, I'd only get 20. But you don't take the 20 out of your, you don't say to yourself, I just lost 20. So there's, I get it. So, but last night, this guy has, evidently he's got a few Bitcoins. I didn't ask him how many. I said, you know, those things are taking kind of a hit the last couple of days. They went from like 105 down to 87. Well, that's all right. I bought them at like 15. I said, well, I understand you're still up and you made a great trade, but it's not really all right. I mean, you're down 15 grand times five. It's, you know, it's 75 grand. No, I don't look at it that way at all. And I'm like,
well, you should.
I said, you know what? I can, if you want me to, and I'm not here to, you know, push business or anything like that. If you want me to, I can hedge that for you. So if it goes back down, you don't lose all of it. Oh no, it's fine. It's fine. I put this much in, and it's way up. And if I lose it, you know, it's okay. And I'm like, what do you mean it's okay? But I'm not going to argue with the guy. But you know what? The amount of people that feel that way, Kevin, with the market, people retired with $1 million, which seems like a lot of money, but it's only a retirement. It's not if you're going to live off it. And the market's up so much the last couple of years, they now have, say, $1.7 million. And they'll say, well, that's all right. If it goes down to $1.4 million, I'm okay with it. Somehow there's a guilt thing here. Like, you shouldn't have made that much money or something. Something's weird. And I remember my brother Dan, president of PTI Securities, real smart guy, and not just because he's my brother. Of course, he'll argue with you about everything, as brothers do. But we were doing a seminar once, and somebody said to him, how come people sell on the bottom? It's so stupid. And Dan says to him, you need to understand the psychology. If somebody thinks they need $1 million for their retirement, you know, you got Social Security coming in, and you're $1 million, 3% a year, you need that to live in. If you're up to $1.5 million or something, you're sort of gleeful. If it goes back to $1 million, then goes to 900, you're way afraid, because now your lifetime budget is now in jeopardy. So that's why you sell at 900, because you don't have anything more you don't have anything left you feel you can lose. Because it's exactly the opposite of what, obviously you'd like to be a seller at $1.5 million and you'd like to be a buyer at 900, right? But that's not what people do. If something's going up, they're buying it. But it goes down if all of a sudden they're afraid. Now, if something happened to this guy's business and Bitcoin got to 50, he might, or 500, 50,000, he might say, oh no, not now, I need it. Now I'll sell it here. But I don't get it. To me, it's, I said, well, again, just to summarize, no point in arguing in a bar. Plus, there's no argument to it. You think one way. And I said, but if you'd have opened an account at PTI and my job was to hedge your Bitcoin at 100,000, which would be a tough do, but I could probably do it. I said, you think you're still up 50. I think we're down 13. I mean, it's just a different mindset. But I don't understand the other mindset, Kevin. You know, it's almost like, if you ever going to play blackjack or play craps with somebody, and all of a sudden they're up $500, it's almost like they feel they need to give $200 back, like they don't deserve to win it. And whenever I use the term, it's still the house's money, I just cringe. So if you can pick up your chips and leave without getting arrested, it's not the house's money anymore, it's yours. I mean, I just, you know what, it's amazing how every few months I have the same conversation with very intelligent people, and it seems like I always lose somehow.
Well, there are reasons I don't gamble, and it is because of the mindset. You know, I don't gamble. I don't bet on sports. I don't do any of that. One, because I suck at it, but two, because it is too volatile for me, and I'm just not interested in getting involved in it.
Well, you know, in school, man, I loved playing poker when I was younger, and I loved playing blackjack because those are games of skill. It's, you know. And I like playing some craps, only because the table is one of the best people shows on earth. you know, you just hope you don't lose too much. You know, you just hope you're hanging in there. But I mean, it is so much fun to watch people when their emotions are running like that. Blackjack's the same way. It's an absolute people show. And I just enjoy being around it. Plus, I was, you know, kind of a half-assed card counter. When I say half-assed, not enough to certainly make a living out of it, but enough to where I at least...
Also not enough to get roughed up?
Yeah, just not enough to... Where you felt like you had a chance. You weren't just the pigeon, you know, sitting there. But, you know, but it was... I used to, you know, pretty much break even. Some trips I'd make a few bucks and some, you know, some trips I didn't. But I never lost that much. Plus, if I lost a few times, a few sit-downs in a row, I'd get pissed off and go to a show. You know, I just want to sit and lose all night. Because it is, you know, it also teaches you, Kevin, I don't know what the mathematical term is. Where's Hal when we need him? Things that are allegedly a 50-50 chance, the streakiness involved is unbelievable. I mean, you would think that if you're playing craps or blackjack, I mean, if you know the basic strategy in blackjack, and you know, which mean when to double down, when to split pairs, all that kind of good stuff, it's roughly a 50-50 game. Say 51 house, 49 you. So it's a little again you. Craps is virtually, if you know what it means, the bet behind the line?
Yep.
It's the only even money bet in Vegas. I don't know how we get off on this topic. You must have done this to me. If you put down, say, $5 on the pass line, all right, what is it, 7-11 you win, 2-3 and 12 you lose, all the other numbers become your point. And then the person keeps rolling to either hits a 7, in which case you lose, or get your point, in which case you win. And, well, if you put the $5 out there and say you roll an 8, or somebody rolls an 8, you get to put, depending on the place, either 5 or 10 or more, say 10, double, they'll say double behind the line bets are double. So you now put $10 behind the line. That's an even money bet. So now the 8, you get paid 6 to 5 if the 8 wins, because guess what? There's 5 8s and there's 6 7s, right? So it's a 6 to 5 bet. If you get a 9, it's 3 to 2, and if you get a 10, it's 2 to 1. Okay, if you do the math on the dice. Well, so that's actually an even money bet. So if you take the 5 that you put down there, that's, you know, say 49% chance, and then you put the 10 down, which is 50% chance, you're really talking about, you know, 49.67, right, on your total bet, which is pretty damn good, right? Mm-hmm. And you would think all night long that you would sit there and win one, lose one, win one, lose one. It's not the way it works. And I don't know, I mean, people have tried to do computer studies as to why sometimes people win 4 or 5 in a row and they get, quote, hot. Or you can't win for losing. You know, in a...
Because that's how randomness works.
Yeah, but you would think you'd never have a...
Randomness isn't just one way, the next way, one way, the next way. Random variance is, it can track. And, you know, your only question when you get hot is there a reason for the streak, or is it just randomness? And, you know, I deal with randomness all the time in terms of, you know, in the quality management world. And, you know, that's really what it's about. You have to identify what's random cause and special cause. And once you do, then, you know, you're in pretty good shape for understanding the process. So I don't know if there are, if there are non-random events that would cause somebody to win 5 or 6 in a row, or 8 in a row or something like that. But the probability would always say that it's not random, that something is happening. But you've got to believe that they're, you know, or do you believe that they're not using special dice or, you know, anything like that? And if you, you know, if they're not, then okay, it's an anomalous outlier.
Well, when you talk, if you spin it over to the stock market, when I first went to University of Chicago, they were the first place that had all the, they had every up and down tick in the New York Stock Exchange back to like whenever the damn thing started, 1890 or something. An uptick meaning if IBM's trading 100, last trade is 100, the next trade's 100 and an eighth, that's an uptick. And if it drops back down to 100, that's a downtick, which is hard to do now because there's all these different black pools and all kinds of stuff. But in the New York Stock Exchange, there was records of every up and down tick for like 100 and some years. So what, who was it? Lorian Hamilton wrote the book, The Stock Market, and they went back and went through all this stuff. I mean, they had computers do it, and they found that there was virtually no correlation between if there was an uptick, whether the next trade would be an uptick or a downtick, or even. You could not get any kind of a pattern. There was a very, very slight pattern where if there was an uptick, the next one would probably be an uptick. But any kind of commissions you had to pay essentially rubbed that out. I mean, now you don't pay commissions in some places, but they run around and find the place where they give somebody else the good trade, which probably makes the uptick more likely because they'll find a space where the next guy gets an uptick. But, you know, I don't want to go into that, but it probably screws it up. But it, so the term came out that the market was really a random walk. That because you couldn't see three upticks in a row and figured the next one was going to be an uptick, that it was a random event. But yet, how many days have we seen, Kevin, where we seem like we go up every day for 2-3 weeks, and all of a sudden we have a couple down days where you can't get in the way of it, and or else it just hits you upside the head. I mean, the streakiness is amazing. And yet, if you go back and look at all the evidence, it looks like one up, one down. And yet...
Well, it looks that way when you calculate the numbers, but it doesn't look that way in time series.
No, it sure doesn't, yeah.
And that's part of the analysis, is it has to include time series. And then you also have to go back and look at things like, you know, has anybody had, you know, if you're looking at individual stocks, you may look at them and correlate it to earnings announcements and things like that. But do people go back and adjust it for restated earnings, as an example? You know, which happens every once in a while. And so, you know, the current earnings report may say one thing, but a restated earnings from 2 years ago may significantly affect the stock price, and that kind of blows your analysis unless you factored that into it.
Well, you also have, what do you think, Russell was talking last week, I don't know if you happen to listen in.
Never listen to that, Russell.
No, I don't want to listen to that guy. By the way, he's not on today. He's in Europe, and we have a young lady named Petra. Well, here's her name, Kevin. I'm going to have to say this 10 times while she's on.
Just ask her to pronounce it for you. She'll tell you.
I can. I've found a place where I can. Petra Bakasova. I just don't want to say it fast 3 times in a row. I don't know what it's going to come out looking like.
It's not that hard.
It is for me. What can I tell you? and you know, he was talking about. I said, how come these stocks are moving, because we do a lot of earnings trades for people. And how come these stocks are moving 2, 3, and 4 times the straddle, which means the market's estimation of how much that the stock is going to move on an earnings announcement. And he's convinced it's because of this Reg whatever, Reg FD, I think it is, this fair disclosure. If you give something out to one analyst, you're supposed to give the information out to everybody, which is, this is a, you know, 5, 8, 10 year ago thing, and maybe it's, but it's kind of morphed into not fair disclosure, Kevin. It's almost morphed into like no disclosure, it seems to me, where you don't have between earnings estimates. There used to be, I'm going to say, out of the, you know, used to be a lot of securities firms, and the way they got business was to do a lot of research, and then they would put, they manage your money, they would put, this long before they had options and all the other stuff, they would put your, you know, Goldman Sachs, for instance, would decide IBM's a buy or GM's a buy or something. Well, they would give that information. They would actually, if they were trading for their best clients, they would actually already be in the IBM. But then the next best clients, you might get a phone call and say, hey, our analysts like IBM at this price, blah, 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 do you want to buy some? And then after that, you know, at 11 in the morning, you might see, you know, on the Dow Jones tape, Goldman Sachs raises estimates on IBM. There was a progression of information. But you'd see, not every day, but maybe every few weeks, somebody from Hornblower and Weeks, analyst raises their rating on IBM, or somebody else from Moody's raises their rating on GM or lowers their rating. There was sort of a...
And if I remember, specific analysts would always be, you know, market movers. You know, they had reputation, and so if they had the right chops, they could... you know, they were taken very seriously.
But they also were people that, I'm going to say, worked real hard, and they didn't just, let's say it was Apple. They'd constantly be talking to the person Apple buys the screens from or something, or whatever it may be. And a person may say, well, yeah, I mean, last quarter they bought 3 million screens, and this quarter looks like they're down to 2.5 million. Now, it's up to you to figure out where they have so many in inventory that they're just cutting back, or whether it means they're selling 500,000 less phones. I mean, they would do whatever they possibly could you know, legally in the supply chain. Hey, you pick up a load of Apple phones every day in your truck. Yeah, I used to go every day. This week I'm only going 3 days. They would. That's the kind of stuff that you would like look for. Were you talking about your supply chain?
Yeah, because your analytics would be okay. Does that mean demand is on its way down now, or does that mean demand sucked so bad last year that we have a lot of inventory?
Well,
and it may or may not pick up this year.
And it may mean that Russell is correct. But the surprising thing is the market hasn't seemed to have reacted and made the straddles bigger. But, I mean, now you rarely see that. And it's not like every week, you know, Kevin O'Neill from, you know, Smith Barney is going bullish on IBM. He's moved his target from 105 to 110 or something. You don't see this kind of, it was never a, I mean, your models, your Black-Scholes models and all those things, one of the assumptions is a continuous flow of information, which you and I know is not true. But it seems like it's less continuous. We're now, the earnings announcement, not only is the numbers important, but essentially the BS the guy comes out with. Ah, man, our numbers are no good, but next quarter looks great, and all of a sudden the stock could be up 20%. Now, you don't know what, and there's nothing that he says to prove that, but then you don't have five analysts going out and say, gee, this O'Neill guy says next quarter looks pretty good, but it looks to me like their suppliers are telling me that they bought less last quarter. How the hell is it going to be any good? So it seems like it's become even more discreet, the information. I don't know if it means people are just getting lazier, they're not doing it, if they're blaming it on Reg FD. But why should somebody from Goldman Sachs do all that work and put it out there when everybody's going to go use, you know, TastyTrade or someplace, or IB, which we use, and do stuff for real cheap? You know, I mean, why would you do that for somebody? Right? You're not getting paid for it anymore. I think maybe there is less information. And that's,
well, actually, I think there's more, but it's so dispersed and so unstructured that it really takes, you know, it takes some really, really almost kind of mad skills for how, you know, how you go about doing the analytics. So, you know, this is getting us into the whole big data analytics thing.
But why don't we go to break and talk about
information that floats out there, but it's not structured. Social media, for example, how do you make sense out of that and turn it into usable data when everybody's wording is completely different for anything they post?
Well, let's go to break. When we come back, let's fight about that, because I used to fight about that with Matty Weber. I mean, the internet is so spectacular at getting me information, but it can't get me the information of the Smith Barney analyst if he's gone. Right?
It might in different ways.
But anyway, we'll be right back. SP Futures up 28, NASDAQ Futures up 151. Be right back.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Well, we're back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Hollander on the board. SP Futures up 29. NASDAQ Futures up 155. Looks like we might be going to have a positive day, but lest we forget, Monday looked like it was going to be a positive day, too, and it ended up getting a rug pulled out of it. I'm not predicting that. I'm just saying a lot of times when you have a bull market, you start the day out on the downside, and I don't think we're in a bear market, but if we are, doesn't mean you won't start it every day up and then turn around the other way. Dow Futures up 111. Individual stocks at Goldman Sachs up 356. Home Depot, which has been on a tear. Get earnings yesterday morning. It was up a bunch yesterday. It's up a bunch today. They and Walmart were kind of leading the world yesterday. We had a little bit of a comeback. Those stocks were up all day. In Europe, we've got the DAX up 368, 1.6%. FTSE up 53.6. Gacron up 102, 1.3. German stocks are up. They just had the election over there, and they had more of a conservative government. I don't know if... a lot of times we celebrate stuff and then we wonder why we did. Nikkei down 95.2%. Hang Seng up 753, 3%. Huge uptick there. 23,787. Shanghai up 34. That's 1% as well. Hang Seng has been amazingly volatile in the last week to 10 days. The bonds, 10 years unchanged, 4.31. The Bund down 1 basis point, 2.43. Japan down 1 basis point, 1.36. Oil, which, Greg will be in later. We have to ask him about this. 68.82. For some reason, Kevin, nobody wants any oil. Everybody keeps talking about $100 oil. It ain't happening, at least not now. Brent down 18 cents, 72.84. Natural gas down 3 cents, 4.14. Gold, which has been banging around here in the mid-2900s. We got clobbered yesterday, but now it's back up $5 today, 29.24. Silver up 24 cents, 32.36. Foreign exchange. Dollar was at an 11-week low, but today it's back to 104.9, which means the euro is down a little bit. British pound 126.5, down a little bit. Japan is 149.52. Crypto, and this one has been taking a pounding. 88,336, only up $82. It was 105,000 not too long ago. And we have yesterday, where were we? The Dow was up 159, S&P was down 28, NASDAQ was down another 260. It's 1.3%, so was 1.3% yesterday, was down Monday, and it was down like 2.5% Friday. So NASDAQ has some bouncing to do here if it's going to. We got for us Traffic Weather Sports.
All right, it is 6:39 here in Chicago, and it is February 26th. Starting out with just a little bit of sports here, for some spring training from the Cubs. The Cubs won over the Diamondbacks 4-2. Moving over to Chicago weather, things are looking a little bit better this week, at least off to a weird start today. We're at 41 degrees right now. We have mostly cloudy and cooler skies, a little bit of rain throughout the day, and we're going to have a high of 44 throughout the whole day. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 58 degrees. Looks like pretty warm and a pretty sunny day as well. We're going to have a high of 89. Over to Chicago traffic. If you're coming in from the south side, expect a little bit of a delays. Let's see, if you're on Dan Ryan, the traffic's pretty heavy. The closer you get to the loop around, that's Roosevelt Road, I-290 West. Other than that, looks like that's all
other
I got.
Other than that, I think you should let Greg in.
Yep, sorry. It was like the moment you're like, okay.
All right, remember what you're talking, there the traffic. He is.
He's at the door, so be right back. Back to you.
Greg is going to help us my interview with Petra, because he knows more about the quant trading stuff than I do these days, so he's going to be kind of my wingman. So it should be good, Kevin. Hey,
Before you get that, do you suppose that oil pricing is that you have competitors on the world market who are listening to Trump's goal of ramping up oil production and saying we need to keep the prices down to make it uneconomical to drill?
I think which
I've seen that before. I remember that during the Obama years.
Well, you remember my view on some of the oil stuff, and that the industry is way bigger than whoever the president happens to be at the time. And for
it is, but the demand. I mean, the demand for energy just keeps growing like crazy.
Well, sure it does. So, but I think
it isn't so much the raw number that we're pulling out is, are we keeping up? And I don't get into oil policy or anything like that. It's just, we could be the United States. We could just as well be the world. But are we keeping up? Are we pulling it out of the ground in the same increments that the demand is asking us to? And when the answer is yes, then the price is going to be stable. When we're pulling more out of the ground, of course, it's going to drive the price down. So, you know, it is bigger than a presidency or an administration, but at the same time, the market still behaves pretty rationally.
We don't get them. we sometimes, Kevin, I wonder what it is with younger people. But anyway, the here's some of the stuff that the president is saying, and I don't want to get into the politics of it, makes no sense economically. I mean, we under his watch and Biden's watch combined have gone from, I could get the numbers up here, like 8 million barrels a day to like 13.5. Well, that has amazingly calmed the world market, because we're not as dependent on anybody else as we used to be. You know, OPEC can jump up and down all they want, and they cut production, and you'll see the oil go from 72 to 74, and 3 days later it's back to 72. Because we've got a level here at 70 that appears to be 72, whatever it is, comfortable with the new, all the advances in the fracking and all that stuff. It appears people can make decent dough at $70-$72 a barrel, and they're comfortable with this level at 13.6 million barrels a day, and it seems to be enough for us and the rest of the world, and it's a price where everybody can hang in here, and it's been pretty darn steady. Now, if you say we're going to make more oil and drive the prices down, that is so economically ignorant. I can't believe the guy, you know, whoever said that, I'm not just talking about the one person, whoever said that even has a job as a janitor. It's the simple fact is, if the price was $30, we would not be doing 13.6 a day, because an awful lot of people where they're drilling don't make money at $30, right? I mean, right now we have an equilibrium that we haven't seen in years, really. Not saying it's perfect, but we have an equilibrium at this price. And it doesn't seem like, you know, countries jumping up and down are knocking us off that price. Now, if Saudi Arabia were to say, okay, we actually can produce at $20 a barrel, maybe they can, I don't know. So we're going to open the spigot, and we're going to be 3 million barrels a day we're going to pour into the market and just screw with everybody else. You're going to see production here go down regardless of what the president says. Because if I can't make money at $50 a barrel, I'm stopping my rig. It is so simple, it's scary. And when people opine against the market, when the market is, there's 21 countries or something that export oil, Kevin. It's a massive market. It's not a question of we're going to pump, baby, pump, and drive the price down to 40. You're not going to get anybody to pump at 40 if their break even's 50, are you?
Well, and that's what I'm talking about. It's not drilling here that's going to drive down the price. It's the competition that current suppliers don't really want, that might have them at least in the short term do price reductions. Just lower the price and to some point where they're still making money, to make it uneconomical for somebody else to go do the same.
Well, you were on. We did a.
It's just a predatory pricing
scheme. Yeah, but you and I, Kevin, I know it was, I think it was us. We were on together with either Carl or Russell one day. This is a while back. I mean a while back, like before COVID. And I dug up some report, or you did, one of the two of us. When oil was down to like $35 a barrel or something, was it you? You must have done this. It was all the. I was going to say. Idiots, or worse, over in Saudi Arabia, how many people are on the dole for oil? Like in the family, and everybody, you know, the third and fourth cousins get a check, and how if oil goes to $35 a barrel, how they're like, how many billion dollars a year in the hole because they owe all these people money, and everybody's got their jets, everybody's got all this other stuff. That when the price was down there, they were gagging, even though oil wise. It was still essentially above their break-even point, but it doesn't matter. Their I use the term overhead rate is monstrous because of all the people they're paying, and they don't want the price down. I mean, they can say we're gonna screw with the world and drive it to $25, but if you're a second cousin, all of a sudden your check's cut off, you're not happy.
Yeah, and I don't think they're gonna drive it that low. I just think they there is a mindset on the world markets that say when new competition wants to come in, we have to make it harder for them. We have to create some barriers to them, some entry barriers to them, and pricing is one way you can do that. it doesn't last. It can't last for long for just the reasons you cited, is that, you know, they still have their targets. They still have, you know, in many cases, especially, you know, Saudi Arabia is a good example of a crappy financial model for their businesses, because, you know, it's predicated on skimming a certain amount out for the royal family, and it's a substantial amount. So it that's a part of it, but, you know, you really don't want someone else coming in flooding the market with oil, and then then the price is down and you have no control over it.
Okay, but didn't we have an article?
So I remember in the 2010 time frame that we'd see price down, okay, slow down domestic production, price up, okay,
oh, yeah,
everybody, let's ramp it back up, okay, price down again, and we were playing swings, and it looked to me anyway like it was competition, you know, competitive swings in the prices, not necessarily derived from the volume of oil that was being produced.
Kevin, didn't we have, your memory might be probably better than mine, didn't we have an article that said in, was it 2020, that the massive, what do they do, a 5-year plan, 10-year plan, whatever the hell they do over in Saudi Arabia, God knows what, that they saw oil now in 2025, or was it whenever we were doing this thing, that the they saw oil at like $100 minimum, and they did all their 10-year budgets based off that number, and how much, who's going to get paid what, and how many 747s you're ordering, so guys could come over here and do stuff to little girls and stuff, and that they had their entire, you know, 10-year plan was based on at least $100 barrel oil or something. Didn't we have that discussion?
And how it's, yeah, I don't remember it, but I'll take your word for it.
Well, it's at 70, they're making money, but nothing like they had sort of planned at. Which,
well, yeah, and so, you know, what's the biggest mistake you can make is you build a budget with a very optimistic, I mean, this would be any business, with really, really optimistic projections, and you say, wahoo, let's go, and you just start spending indiscriminately. And, yeah, what you're describing is what they did. It's just that their business model isn't on spending indiscriminately around your business and getting bloated. Their business model is built on siphoning off the money and spending it indiscriminately on a personal level.
Well, $30 a day times, you know, 10 million barrels or whatever, 8 million barrels every single day, that's Major League Scratcho.
Oh, yeah.
God. Can you explain to me why... I guess we're never going to get into this. Maybe this is more of a Wayne question, but we're up at 13,494, which is actually down a little bit from December. This is 2025. December was our highest month, 13,631. Of course, if you were an idiot, you would say, geez, it's the 3 months Trump's been in there, it's like down. Well, you know, I'm not going to do that. But we've been in this mid 13 something something number for kind of quite a while. And when Biden took office, it was like 11, all right? And when Trump took office, which would have been, what, 2017, right? It was 997. But that's unfair to Trump. Unfair to Trump's time in office. Because it had gotten up to 13, and then the COVID hit, and it went flying back down. So essentially, in the Biden administration,
you had a weird event in there.
Yeah, so it went, it peaked out at 13 in Trump's, in February of 2020, which is essentially the month before COVID, right? And then it went down that November to 10.5, which is a big drop. And obviously, nobody was going anywhere. And then from December 2021, when, January 2021 is when Biden got in office, and it went down to about 10.9, and then it started going flying back up from there. And so it's on somewhat of the same line as it was before COVID with both guys, is the fair assessment. I mean, I don't know. Doesn't mean that, you know, it couldn't have been more under Biden, or it could have been less, or who the hell knows. But the fact is, if you look at the numbers, then...
Well, there's one more weirdo event in there, and that's that we did a lot of depletion to the strategic oil reserve. So that, you know, that event has to be factored in there as well.
Well, that's an addition to the production.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I wonder if that was that was very early on. That's when we dropped from.
It was around the midterms.
Okay, because the midterms we actually had gotten down to 11, 10, 9 in there before it started to ramp up again. It was a full year before it started creeping back up with COVID. It didn't start going back up till July of 2021. So there was essentially a dead year in there. Trump's last few months and last 6 months and Biden's first seven. And I don't think either one of them had anything to do with their policy. It just happened because of COVID, right?
Sounds about right.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I... why do you think the only president, going back here as far as I can go, the only president that had a decrease in oil production during his term was Bush, the second Bush. What funky was going on with that dude? I mean, did they have something going with the Saudis, or what was the deal there? I mean, weird.
It could have been, because that's, you know, a relationship that doesn't get explored enough. But it also was, he had a pretty substantial, you know, all the dot-com bombs in that recession. Didn't that happen on his watch?
Well, that was in 2007.
Oh, okay.
But he entered it. He entered when? January 2001, right? In the compare this to today. I mean, what I was saying earlier, you know, I speak the numbers pretty well. It doesn't mean I know what I'm talking about. But when you wonder why we're so much energy prices now are more stable, January of 2001, our oil production was 5,900,000 barrels a day. Now we're 13.6. Well, that's a huge difference in the world market, and who's beholden to who, right, Kevin?
Yeah, a little.
So he left office.
Well, you know what else you had? You're talking lower domestic oil production. No, I can't speculate. I don't know. I wouldn't have an informed thought about it.
I mean, because he left office in what? 2009, correct? In January? We're down to 4.9 million. The zeros are off here in this thing. I mean, oil production was down kind of 11% during the 8 years the guy was in office. And I got to believe our oil demand was up huge during that time. I mean, now we didn't have the fracking, right? So that's fracking, I think, came into
not to the degree that we had. We, you know, that sort of came after the 2008 crash, followed the fracking boom.
So I mean, you know, some of it was, like I said, a lot of these events are bigger than the people in the White House. You know, a real lot, because this industry is essentially a worldwide industry, and it went up. Let me see, when Obama was, what the hell did he leave? He got in and he left in what, 2016? And what are we up to there? We were up to it would have been what, January 2017? We were up to 8.9 million.
Yeah, and that was when we were just pulling oil like crazy out of Permian, out of North Dakota, even out of Pennsylvania and Ohio.
But we're 50% higher than that now.
Yeah.
And,
and that doesn't surprise me, because the demand for energy is so much higher now.
Well, we had that one blip. I forget what it was.
It doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
Because the price got down to what? $29-$30 at one point. Well, that's gonna bury your business. Because, you know, these rigs, there's another thing I have in my favorites.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. And then we saw a lot of world market, when all that was happening, and it really did, you know, it was this big spike in the world market, the world supply of oil, and some of that was driving the prices down. But I also think you had, overseas competitors saying, "Holy crap, we got to slow this down. We can't let them keep doing it, you know, going great guns. We have to make it uneconomical for them to continue to drill at the rates that they are." And I absolutely believe that was part of what was going on.
Oh, sure. Well, remember the oil service, whenever you have a futures contract, this is kind of basic educational. I'll lob this in for 30 seconds, Kevin.
Yeah, because we never got to analytics.
Yeah, well, we got Friday. The whenever you have a futures contract, the reason why the futures contract and the spot contract eventually come together is because if you have the oil or the soybeans or the corn, and all of a sudden the price is different, you can deliver. So in other words, if you owe somebody 5,000 bushels of corn, and the reason why the futures price and the spot price come together at the end is because you can shuffle your 5,000 bushels and go, here's my corn, okay, and I'm short the contract, but here's the corn, now I'm flat. Same thing happens with oil, but there's only a couple of delivery spots. As a matter of fact, it might only be one. It's in Cushing, Oklahoma. And remember, so many people delivered their oil that there was no room for it. There was no storage. It's if you could get it there.
I remember that.
Yeah. And so a lot of the contracts, the futures contracts, are not as easy as showing up with 5,000 with a railroad car, which isn't easy either. A railroad car full of corn. I mean, when you say 5,000 bushels is the contract, the reason why it is, Kevin, is 5,000 bushels fits on a railroad car, right? I mean, there's some logic to a lot of this stuff, even though people don't think there is. Anyway, we have, on Friday we need to talk. This is the last weekend for college hoops, right? And then the tournaments are next week.
I'm trying to think. Men's might go a little bit longer, but this is the last weekend for women's for sure.
I thought the Irish only had two games left, and they go.
That's probably true.
And today they'd be in the tournament, but they'd be playing in the play-in round, right?
They would be in the ACC tournament.
Is everybody in there, or a few bottom scrubs?
There's a few teams because the conference is so damn big that they can't have them all and get the tournament done inside of a week. So they're, you know, the Irish still have a chance of falling out of it, but I think they play Clemson this week, and Clemson's good.
And they're playing somebody else who's good too.
That's tonight, and I know there's a home game on Saturday because it's on my calendar.
I just looked; it's somebody good too. Now Marquette looked good last night. They're starting to play better. They had a three losses in a row thing, but they're playing better now. So my buddy Bill is all over those guys because he went to Marquette. I like watching those guys. I like their coach.
Yeah, Shaka Smart is a good coach, and they play a good style of basketball.
So. Is anybody going to knock off this Auburn? They looks like they've become a pro team quicker than anybody else.
No, I am absolutely astounded that first of all that it's Bruce Pearl succeeding at that level. Anyway, that isn't so astounding, but you know the way they're covered now, and what a great guy Bruce Pearl is.
Oh, yeah.
He had a show cause. Penalty where Auburn couldn't hire him until that expired because the NCAA, effectively banned him from being a coach for his shenanigans at Tennessee.
If you're a winner, nobody seems to care, Kevin. It's bizarre.
Yeah, well, if you're a winner, it doesn't make you a great guy.
I mean, a lot of people don't care if their financial analyst is an ex murderer as long as he makes some money, right?
And that's fine, and they can talk about him that way, but don't tell me what a wonderful fellow is. Don't tell anybody from Illinois that he's a wonderful fellow.
I know, it's unreal. SP Futures up 27, NASDAQ Futures up 147. Kevin, we'll talk on Friday. I'm sure we'll have all kinds of stuff. We'll hope the market rallies between now and then. We'll have three more losing days we have to talk about. We're going to be right back.
You got Petra on the call.
We have Petra in a minute. We're going to have a very quick break, and then we're going to introduce her, and this will be fun. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
There's something happening here.
What it
Load up back, Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. We have Andrew on the board. We also have Greg Pappas in studio to help us out here this morning. SP Futures up 26. NASDAQ Futures up 138. We'll see if that holds. We've had a couple days this week where it hasn't. I'm pleased to introduce Petra Bakasova, Chief Executive Officer of the Hull's new firm. And all you have to do is read the first couple lines here and you're impressed. Petra's background is in algorithmic trading across multiple asset classes, mathematical modeling, and risk management. I'm impressed immediately. She joined Hull Investments LLC in 2014, and I kept reading. I always got down to the part where she also has an MBA from the University of Chicago, and I go, hey, we got one thing in common at least. Petra, welcome. How are you?
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing great. How are you doing?
We're doing good. It's raining a little bit, but that's okay. We also have Greg Pappas in the studio, and I understand you know Greg from hanging at this, I won't say hanging, visiting the series once in a while.
Absolutely. It's the best establishment. I might go there after this interview and get me some Bobby Browns.
Drinks on me.
Bobby Browns are the best. you're not part of the group that used to drink at that hour in the morning, are you? They used to do that way back in the day.
Yeah, you would see people there at all hours. I always waited after the market close.
Yeah. You know, when you get off work at 3 o'clock, there's plenty of time. You know. So Petra, do us a favor, will you? I tried to give a little bit of history from when I was on the floor a long time ago. I mean, the Blair Hull Group, and I know Blair Reason. If I walked down the sidewalk, he might not recognize me, but I would him, and we've talked on several occasions. He was always kind of in the lead in the mathematical algorithm of trading because, I mean, when I started, not tell you what age I am, I mean, it was illegal to have CNBC on the floor. You couldn't have a computer with you. I don't even think you could have a calculator. It was illegal. Because they didn't want to give anybody any type of advantage. Well, that obviously has changed dramatically since 1981. The Hull Group was very good at putting like auto quote systems, stuff that really nobody else did, or a couple other people tried. But Blair was just give us a little bit of a history of how all that went, and now the stuff you're doing today is so incredible. Just give us a brief history of how you got here, and then tell us what you're doing now.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to. And I think, you know, we can definitely talk a little more about like the whole trading and their operating room and their computers they brought down to the floor. But I think I would go a little further back. Obviously, Blair needs no introduction around here as a very famous trader. But what not everybody maybe knows or knows the details of is how he became a trader. And so I think we want to go back about extra 10 years and like talk a little about his blackjack background. He was on one of the original card counting teams out in Vegas. So, you know, back in the early 70s, he joined one of these teams with Ed Thorpe and spent his weekends in Vegas. So what they would do, every weekend, 50 trips per year, they go down to Vegas, play for 8 hours a day, play 100 hands an hour of blackjack. And so, you know, if you're doing the math really quickly, 100 hours, 100 hands an hour, 8 hours a day, 50 days or 50 trips a year over 5 years, he ends up playing about 200,000 hands. And you can treat this as a trading strategy. It was a very systematic algorithm. You're counting the cards that you have seen and you're estimating the edge of the remaining deck. And such a trading strategy, I don't know if you would take a guess what kind of Sharpe ratio it yields, but it yields a Sharpe ratio of about 6.
Petra, didn't Thorpe, who wrote the book Beat the Dealer, by the way.
Yes.
He was my guy when I used to go. I'm going to say I was a half-assed card counter. That wasn't two things I'll interject. If you say, how can somebody play that many hands? If you went to a $5 table and you bet $10, you were allowed to play two hands. So some people played two and three and four hands every time the guy dealt, which I'm sure that's what those guys did. They just didn't play one hand at the table with six other people. They probably had three or four hands for themselves, would be my guess. But anyway, didn't Thorpe also have an option modeling system?
He did later on. And kind of like, I guess, both him and Blair, you know, now we're talking late 70s, and they're looking around to see you know, what else could be interesting for them to do. I guess, you know, the blackjack strategy was interesting. Really high sharp doesn't scale super well. So they both go to a conference in 1981.
Also, excuse me, also when they start using four decks, it kind of puts a millstone around it.
Yes. The casino's kind of wised up a little bit. So they go to the National Conference on Gambling and Risk in 1981, and they both present papers. So Ed Thorpe presents a paper called Fear versus Greed in the Stock Market. And Blair presents a paper, Stock Market Timing and Gambling. And in this paper, Blair examines a couple different strategies. He looks at market timing and concludes that there is a potential edge. The sharp ratio is not as high as in blackjack, but it's a very scalable strategy. And then he also writes that there is another alternative, which is options market making, and he concludes that there's a higher sharp ratio than market timing, and it's also very scalable, so he's going to go with that.
And this is the not to interrupt, but I'm just trying to, for the stuff we've talked about to listeners before, this kind of is going right in the face at the same time of all the research, most of it at the University of Chicago, regarding random walk theories and, you know,
the efficient market hypothesis.
Yeah, the efficient market stuff, and, you know, even a monkey can throw darts at a thing and do as well as the best advisor. So this is kind of contrary stuff, what you're talking about at the time.
Yes, at the time it's controversial, and I wouldn't say it has become universally accepted, but I think a lot has changed since 1980s, and, you know, namely, I would say, like, a lot of the changes are, and you guys mentioned this earlier today, you know, all the data that's available today on the internet. So there's so much data to analyze that maybe wasn't readily and real-time available in the 80s. And we do have much more powerful computers. So in terms of, like, what kind of algorithms and models we can build, that has changed drastically. And, you know, even the financial instruments and the markets have changed a lot. So, like, in the 80s, I'm sure it was a better time to be making markets in options. You know, the computers were not as expensive, not as powerful, so there was, like, more opportunity for modeling. It was less of an arms race, but it also made market timing harder because the spreads were wider, the markets were not as liquid, the execution trading in and out to make directional bets was, you know, would eat away more of your edge. And now, you know, today the options market making is a lot harder. It's been concentrated to a couple firms, but at the same time, the markets have become very liquid, very narrow. So when we're trying to make directional bets about what the S&P 500 is going to do tomorrow, we incur a lot less of trading costs.
Hey, Petra, when you say a sharp of 6, could you describe just about how good that is in terms of risk reward and how much people actually pay for a strategy like that?
Oh, it would literally look like a Ponzi scheme. Like, you would, if you saw these returns in some kind of a financial company, I mean, they would blow every hedge fund in the world out of the water. This would be basically, I don't even know on 1 year how many losing days you would expect, but very, very few.
Yeah, a sharp ratio of 6 for everybody who's wondering.
Why don't you define what the sharp ratio is before you go too much further? A lot of people probably don't know.
Petra?
When you say, define a sharp ratio for those that aren't there.
Oh, yes. It's basically a ratio of, without complicating too much, return versus volatility. So if your strategy returns 20% a year, I guess excess returns, so you subtract the risk-free, divided by volatility. So if you have a 20% return with 20% volatility of your strategy, then it's a sharp one.
Okay, but
the higher the sharp, what she's getting at is the higher the sharp, the better. And once you start getting over 1, that means it's impressive. And by the time you get to 6, people are paying you hundreds of millions of dollars to put that in. And you don't
What you don't want is a 20% return with 3 or 4 times during the year when you're up and down 40%. That's just okay. You want less volatility and greater returns, correct?
Exactly. So you're shooting to maximize your return, subject to minimizing your volatility.
You want a calm 20%. You don't want a crazy 20%.
So if he's at the casino for 50 weeks out of the year, maybe in a sharp ratio like that, maybe he's drawing down 3 or 5 times. It's depending on... It's a very, very desirable strategy when you get above sharps, above, call it 2. I mean, people start to really look about scalability, and once you get to like 6, then it's real competitive.
Pat, for a little bit of knowledge, I'll throw you, which you probably already know, in Puerto Rico back like in the 50s and 60s, when you played blackjack, the casino by rule could only use one deck and had to deal down to the last card.
Oh, wow.
Talk about... even I could make money doing that.
you wouldn't
have to be as quick as Blair. I mean, because that way they couldn't shuffle up on you, right? No matter what.
So here's another question. What's the new edge?
Yeah, what's the new edge?
How have we morphed from card counting to option market making to what's going on in the new space?
Okay, so, you know, kind of going back to his presentation, so back then he concluded options market making was the way to go, and then after he sold the firm to Goldman, for a couple of years, he focused on things outside of financial markets, and then 2008 hits, and, you know, Blair's portfolio, just like everybody else's portfolio, suffers very painful losses. And he sort of remembers his presentation and revisits the topic of market timing. And he reads the newest academic articles. And kind of what you said earlier, it used to be a very controversial topic. I feel like to some extent it still is at the University of Chicago. You know, we both, I don't know if you ever sat through Gene Fama's class. I did. And he's a big efficient market.
I read a lot. I did not have him for class, but in a couple other classes, we had to read all his stuff. So, got me to sort of the same place, but not quite. Maybe. Go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's still, I wouldn't say it's widely accepted, but at the same time, I think more and more articles are coming with a little bit of defense of market return predictability. People are saying, okay, so the edges are not big, but, you know, if you're careful about not overfitting your models, and if you're careful about your betting strategy, there is a good chance you can improve your investors' outcomes. And that kind of like ties back this whole blackjack into what we're doing now. So I would say like the takeaway from blackjack is like these are not like none of Blair's plays were some kind of crazy Hail Marys when he would, you know, just make millions of dollars in the casino one night. These were like very systematic, you know, hundreds and thousands of bets with a really small edge. And then you're placing them all over and over again, and you bet proportionally to the size of your advantage. And then you have a risk management system in place so that you stay in the game, so that you don't blow up. And basically, he took all of these kind of philosophical investment tenets and put it into Hull Tactical, which is the current iteration and which brings us to today. So Hull Tactical was founded in 2013 as the asset management wing of Blair's company. And basically what we wanted to do, so like between 2008 and 2013, Blair hired a group of quants to basically sift through all the academic articles on market timing and try to build some models. And they were sort of liking the models they were seeing. They were trading them internally. And then we decided it was time to show some of this to public. And we decided to launch an exchange-traded fund, which would incorporate some of these models and offer them to the clients.
Petra, back up a little bit. I mean, Greg and I, and I guess I shouldn't say it, some of the... We have kind of this ongoing debate. Matter of fact, the first part of the show, we were having some of the, you know, the ease of gathering information now is so much better, but you can't gather information for people who have been laid off, right? I mean, you don't have as many serious IBM analysts as you used to have. I mean, and IBM doesn't give out the amount of information they used to give out. And, I mean, there's much more access to the information, but is the information as good, I guess, is my question.
That is a good question. I mean, So the raw data is out there, because even the IBM analyst was looking at, you know, the raw fundamentals and the raw macro data. So the data is still being collected. And now basically the question is, how much value was the IBM analyst adding versus now somebody like us has to try to replicate their work? And to some extent, that's what we're doing. So we're sort of becoming the IBM analyst. And so I think the raw information is still out there. It's still being analyzed and processed, but maybe the people who process and analyze the information now have different titles and maybe use slightly different techniques.
How do you make the determination? I know I'm off the wall here on this one, but it seems to me, and I don't, you know, you guys have a lot of people doing this, that way more news today that moves markets is not the market. I mean, if if the Fed decides to, you know, start pouring money into the system, it almost doesn't matter what the IBM guy thinks. The market's going up. I mean,
Trump tweets.
I mean, IBM might not go up or go up more than the other place. The analytics. In just my observation, and you tell me I'm wrong, which is fine. It seems like you might be able to say, okay, even if retail sales are down, that Home Depot is going to stand out because they can raise price. It seems like the macro numbers seem to be affecting the market on a daily basis almost more than the individual stock stuff. Is that just a crazy observation of somebody sitting there? In other words, if you guys are negative on the market, and all of a sudden the Fed decides to double the money supply, guess what? It's going up. I mean, how do you figure out industry specific news versus other kind of news that affects it?
I probably have to agree with you. And the piece of evidence I would provide, so we look at 30, 40 different indicators, and we sort of know which indicators have been important in our models and which continue to drive the model. And one of the things you said was the Fed. And we do see a ton of our edge over the last years came from looking at the FOMC, that's the Federal Open Market Committee, announcements and looking at rate decisions. And then a lot of it came from sort of looking at short-term market sentiment. So we would look at, you know, some of the market implied sentiment. We would look at moves in VIX and recent moves in stock market, but we would use all these like aggregated sentiment data from surveys and from, you know, asset managers and even from social media. And like the social media signals in particular can be really tricky. We've definitely seen some regime breaks. I think the first time Donald Trump got elected, we saw a big shift on, you know, how the social media sentiment moved the markets. But I do agree with you. It seems less about...
We were limit down at night, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
We were limit down and then all the way back up.
Yep.
All the way back up. Yeah, we had some resting orders overnight, just sitting in the market. I remember that was an interesting day.
Oh yeah, I bet when you got filled, you were unhappy about it. Then an hour later, you said, "Hey, that was a great trade."
Oh yeah. It's
funny how that happens.
And by the end of the day, we're like, "Okay, this kind of worked out."
No, I'm not an idiot. I'm a genius.
Yeah.
But how do you? But it seems like the world is the Washington world, and I don't want to get into political discussion. It's, to me, it's much more difficult to figure out what the Fed's doing when they don't give you the money supply numbers every week. I mean, it seems like the information we're getting keeps getting worse and worse. I mean, somebody's getting it, but I don't know. I'm not getting it. I mean, hopefully you guys are, but
Do you think there's a reason for that, Tom?
Yeah. I guess where I'm getting to the... You guys have got...
You just brought out the tinfoil hat.
Yeah, I know. Well, but I mean, duh. But I'm saying, I would love to see, I guess if you had a blackboard, educated me, which I could sure use, on like the 30 variables you use. I think most people would say, yeah, but boy, that makes a lot of sense. These people know what the hell they're doing. How do you weight the variables? How do you decide which one's more important? It seems like one would be important for a couple of months and it'd drop off. It's like the CPI. For 30 years, nobody looked at it. You know, now all of a sudden it's the biggest thing. Now, were you guys, how do you anticipate that instead of being something we have up there we don't even know why, to being something we better really look at? And who makes, that has to be fascinating to do. I mean, I'm jealous.
I would say that's, you know, I'm not saying it's 100% of what we do, but that is a huge topic, and we sort of, you know, we have been working on the models for more than 10 years now, and I think if we speak 10 years from now, we'll still be working on the models. There's always new techniques, and we try to be as systematic as possible, and we're really transparent about what we do, so if somebody wants to get into the details, we recently published a paper called Micro Alphas, where we talk about specifically, okay, we take these 30 indicators, we put them into a elastic net regression, which allows us to regularize and figure out the weights. But without going like full-on academic, we build models that tell us how to weight the variables. And it's equal parts arts and science, because kind of as you said, like the relationships change. And that is 100% what we believe. So as you said, inflation doesn't matter all the time. Suddenly it matters. Sentiment, sometimes it matters more, sometimes it matters less. And there's all these like weird seasonal anomalies that for whatever reason still exist, like the turn of the months, the selling mays, some pre-announcement drifts. And so basically what we do and what the models do, they kind of look at historically how strong these relationships have been and weight them proportionally to the strength of their historical signal. And then we, you know, refit and rebalance these models pretty frequently, probably like once a month.
Wow.
So as this, the new data comes in, the indicators that are becoming weaker and weaker are getting constantly downweighted, and eventually, you know, there's these cutoffs. They can be completely eliminated from a model for a period of time. And then, you know, if they start picking up again, we'll eventually pick them up. So we're never going to be, you know, exactly day one when inflation starts to matter again. But, you know, if inflation becomes more and more important, we will, over the time, increase its weight and consider it more and more.
Yeah, it would seem like... I'd love, maybe we'll talk a little bit more and then we'll go to break. When we come back, maybe give us an example of, you know, five out-of-market things you look at. And I guess I have a question. You know, I took a couple of modeling classes so long ago that I don't even remember the teacher, let alone the content. But it seems like some of the stuff that happens outside the market is like, they're like discrete events. You know, in other words, well, you know, what if an asteroid hits New York? Like, I can't put a percentage on that. It's either going to happen or it's not. I mean, those make modeling very difficult, don't they?
They absolutely do. And there's things that we can capture through some kind of proxies. You know, if there's some kind of a war situation or some, you know, international tensions, a lot of times it will pop up in like oil prices or shipping prices or something like that. But then there's things that we are just not going to capture. So, you know, the bad news, and for the sake of full disclosure to our clients, if the asteroid hits New York tomorrow, like, our model's not going to know about it today.
You guys don't have a big telescope?
We're on the only 16th floor. We can't quite see the sky from here. All I see is the building next door.
Well, I mean, when something wacky happens and it affects the market, I'll bet you guys all sit around and go, why didn't we see that one coming? I bet you guys have that conversation all the time. It's fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. We're always like, is there anything we could have done to know about this? So, you know, and a lot of times we do find stuff, and sometimes we don't. But we always look.
I mean, when you look at the option movement, and we're going to break here in a little bit, does that tell you stuff? I remember back before 9/11 when my buddy Dr. J, he had one of, well, you guys probably already had it, but he had one of those models that would tell you the increase in
in unusual option activity.
Unusual option activity. And the amount of put trading in the airlines and other stuff went off the chart a few days before 9/11. Matter of fact, the same thing happened. I mean, you guys probably know this better than me, but I think it happened in the Israeli market before the big when everybody invaded, killed all those people, took the hostages 3 years ago, whatever, however long ago it was. There was an increase in put activity in the Israeli market, wasn't there? I mean, you guys, I mean, you have the wherewithal to kind of watch all that. How often does it become informative? You know, if the put trading of United Airlines triples someday, I don't think I would make the conclusion that a plane's heading for a building. But it's
yeah.
I mean, how do you decide whether it's real info or just something that happened?
Yeah. So we do, to kind of go back to your initial question, like, we do care about the activity in options market, and CBOE has been really good about, you know, publishing all sorts of data and all sorts of indices. We track the risk reversal index. We look at the put right index. I know for the longest time the call put ratio was a big market indicator. So we do care. And a lot of times, as you said, like, you see some activity and you don't necessarily know why it matters. Like, the way we use the information, we look at what's happening right now and historically, what did similar moves mean for the market? So, you know, if we've seen something similar in the past, did the markets go up or down? So a lot of times, you know, after the fact, we try to understand why the market moved the way we moved. But as far as, like, just what the model is going to tell us to do tomorrow, the model just cares about, okay, last time this happened, market went up, or last time this happened, market went down.
So there's everything you do, even though you're getting all this information, there's somebody still has to sort of interpret it, right?
Yes, yeah, 100%. So that's probably why, you know, we're never getting rid of portfolio managers, because we can fit the models, but, you know, one, we have to be able to explain to clients about, you know, why we bought today or why we sold today. And two, somebody does need to understand the models and what they do and when they go crazy. It's never going to, you know, as much as AI and machine learning is a big buzzword, it's never going to replace humans, because somebody still needs to supervise these models and these machines.
So Hal's not going to be around anytime soon in the business.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Somehow, every time we have a new technological advancement, we end up with more work and not less work.
Hey, what do you say we go to break? We come back. You can tell us a little bit about the ETF, because I was reading up on that. It looks pretty fascinating. And how many ETFs? We started our signature thing here, Petri, is something we call a protected index program. We started that in 1997, when there was only one index. It was a hell of a lot easier to do business where all you had was the spider, the S&P, right? Now there's more ETFs than there are stocks, aren't there?
100%. I think it's 8,000 or something. There's definitely a ton of ETFs out there, and there are new ETFs being launched every day.
And you guys are in the managed ETF, which is a fairly recent phenomenon. But when we come back from break, you can talk all about that. The first ones used to be, I won't say dummies, but they were, you have the 500 stocks at State Street Bank, and, you know, they're in the S&P, and there was no management to it. It was just, that's what you bought and sold. Now it's obviously evolved past that, and maybe you can take us through that after break. S&P futures up 32 now. NASDAQ futures up 173. We're trying our best to come back from some bad days. We'll see if it hangs in there. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you are aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. And I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Lone Wolf Bank Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Out. Andrew on the board. Greg Pappas in studio. S&P futures up 33. NASDAQ futures up 180. So it looks like we're making our trying to come back here. Home Depot's up again today, 661. These are stocks in the Dow. Had a big move up yesterday as well, as they claim they're getting people in the stores and people are starting to spend again. It kind of conflicts with some of the retail sales number, but I think they maybe are doing better than everybody else. They and Walmart appear to be the standouts in that area, so you know, obviously we're going to be hanging into that. Over Europe, a big move out of the DAX, 385, 1.7. They had their elections a couple days ago. I don't know if that's part of it, but they've been up a couple days in a row. FTSE up 58.7%. CAC around up 112, 1.4%. Asia, big moves to the upside. These guys have gotten amazingly volatile over in the Hang Seng, and we'll ask. I'm dying to actually ask Petra how they work foreign markets into their model, because I bet it's fascinating. Nikkei down 95, call that flat. Hang Seng up 753, that's 3.2%. That's a lot. 23,787. I think, Greg, was it 6 months ago? These guys were 16-something? They're up like, what, 40, 50%? Shanghai up 34, that's over 1%. Bonds haven't been doing much. 4.29 are unchanged. The Bund down 2 basis points to 2.42. Japan down 2 basis points, 1.35. Oil cannot get out of its own way. Greg's going to probably comment on that a little bit. 68.87. Didn't we call a breakout at 75? So much for our call, Greg. It broke back down. Brent down 15 cents, 72.87. Natural gas down a dime, 407, still a little bit over $4. RBOB down a penny, 195. Gold, a little bit of a bounce today. It's been down the last couple days, but it's still hanging around on this mid-2900 number, up $6, $29.24. Silver up 25 cents, that's almost a full 1%, $32.39. Copper up a dime, $4.58. Foreign exchange, dollar's been sinking down today, up just a little bit, with the euro at 104.89, and the British pound at 126.6. Crypto, and these guys have been taking a bath the last couple days, was down 7,000 yesterday at Bitcoin. Now, today down 491, 87.762. And yesterday, just a quick review, Dow was up 159, S&P was down 28, NASDAQ was down 260. It's another 1.3%, so they were down, I'm going to say, almost 5% since Friday, maybe 4.5%. So that's a big move. They need a big bounce to get back to where they were. Andrew, what do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
All right, it is 7:35 here in Chicago, February 26th. Just a little bit of sports here. The Cubs won over the Diamondbacks in their latest game in spring training. For Chicago, weather is currently 37 degrees. It's going to be rainy and cloudy. A little bit of drizzles throughout the day. We're going to have a high of 41. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 58 degrees, but they're going to have clear skies and sunshine throughout the day. They're going to have a pretty warm high of 89. And finally, for Chicago traffic, things are more in the red than I have seen in a pretty long time. If you're on the inbound, I expect delays from nearly every direction. If you're on the outbound, things are really slow on the Eisenhower and the
I'd turn back if I were you. Is that what you're saying?
It is one of those days. Yeah, yeah. Earlier accident from last night where the Kennedy was blocked by, I believe, two lanes were blocked by a bunch of spilled metal pipes. That's cleared up, but the traffic has not, the resulting traffic from that. So, yeah, it's pretty wild out there, especially on the Kennedy today. So, back to you, Chief.
Petra, we want to make sure you have some time to talk about the tactical funds, because obviously, that's where the rubber meets the road. Why should anybody invest in some of this? But I'm just kind of curious. When I saw the big moves in the Hang Seng and the Nikkei in the last few months, where does that stand on your list of things to watch? Is it, if China's up 3%, does that mean anything? Does it mean a little bit? How do you handicap something like that?
To be truthful, not a whole lot. So in our research so far, the U.S. markets mostly care about the U.S. and are driven by the U.S. So there's probably a little bit of spillover that happens. You know, obviously, if China's struggling and in different ways. It's going to affect production, and then we'll see it, you know, in shipping activity, and we'll see it in, you know, some of the goods ordered, shipped, produced. But generally speaking, we have not seen a ton of spillover effect from Asian markets over to the U.S. markets.
Is that recent, or, I mean, you guys go back years on this stuff. Are there times when it does make a difference and other times it doesn't?
It does vary over time. I wouldn't say it ever popped up as a very significant predictor for us.
Interesting. What if you had to pick five that you guys use that nobody would ever think of? What would they? What are some of the outside of market things you guys watch?
Ooh, I don't know. I mean, like, hard to say. Nobody ever think of, but I'll give you some unique ones, and some of them are pretty old. You know, I think one that you might know about, this goes back to like 1970, work by Norm Fosbach, is the low of the high lows. So we would look at what percentage of the listed stocks are at the new 52-week highs and what percentage of the stocks are at 52 weeks low. And then we sort of look at, you know, how does kind of this like dispersion of return impacts, and it seems to be predictive for future returns. So that might be kind of a interesting one. And then another one that is probably one of my favorite indicators is, and I mentioned a little bit earlier, is the FOMC pre-announcement drift. So for many, many years, and it kind of depends on who the Fed chair is, I think it got much stronger with Alan Greenspan and kind of continued to be strong ever since he was the Fed chair. There always seemed to be excess returns once the uncertainty about what the Fed is going to do, and that seems to move the market. So like the day or 2 days leading up to the Fed announcements, I guess the information starts leaking or the markets start to anticipate, and as soon as it's confirmed, a lot of people who maybe pulled back because they were waiting for the rate decision tend to come back to the markets. So that would be another one. And then maybe one that everybody has thought about, but I think there's a lot of different flavors of how you can estimate this. One of my favorite effects, because you would think it shouldn't exist and it does, is momentum. And what we do a different flavor of momentum. We look at state-dependent momentum. So we found that in different market regimes, the strength of momentum is very different. And in certain market regimes, sometimes you actually see a short-term reversal as opposed to momentum. And then another one, I would say...
Was that influenced at all by Cliff Asness?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, like, he sort of started this work, like, many... I mean, how far back does this go? Like, 80s? So this is not a new concept, and I think people, you know, tried to look for different flavors, but I think, you know, that was definitely when everybody sort of accepted it as a known fact. And interestingly enough, for how far back it goes, it never got priced away. And that's sort of what fascinates me about a lot of these indicators, because the efficient market theory would tell you, like, oh, as soon as the information is known, it will get priced away. And there are all these things that have existed for decades that never got priced away. And that would be a very interesting discussion about, like, why these things just don't get priced
Petra,
away.
Petra, if you were to take a gang of the quants and interview 100 retail traders, retail clients, doesn't make them bad. They're retail clients. You'll find out that people buy because stuff's going up and they sell because stuff's going down. And,
yeah.
And then you wonder why there's momentum. There it is. There it is, right? I mean, it's people's kind of mentality. I mean, if you were to come on today and say, Hull Trading, and I'm not putting words in your mouth, decides that, you know, turtle legs out of Zimbabwe are the next biggest thing, I guarantee I'd get a call from people wanting to buy turtle legs.
Yeah, I don't know if it would be us, but there's a lot of movers in the market that, you know, whatever they announce, people will just go with them or they'll go against them. But Yeah, I guess that's a good point.
Is there a Jim Cramer index?
Or the reverse Jim Cramer.
Yeah, the reverse Jim Cramer is doing okay. I'm not sure what the methodology is, but I mean, yeah. That could be a pretty good one, at least.
Petra, our friend Greg here is actually, he's heisted a book I found here. It's the original fundamental or technical strategies of Joe Granville, which is before your time. And he was the guy before, when the market didn't go anywhere for 14 years, told everybody to sell stocks every day. So there's always guys. Like, what? How do you guys make, I know I'm kind of skipping around, but boy, just when you're talking, you're giving me questions. How do you account for, you know, like the seven stock phenomenon of the last few years where, you know, the market has been moved by essentially big stocks, which happened really in 2000. How do you gauge how long that momentum is going to go and when, if ever, that's going to break and what kind of damage it does to other stuff? I mean, you could have been long all kinds of stocks in the last 2 years and not made any money. I mean, if you weren't in the right ones. How do you guys account for that?
Yeah, and that's been really interesting and maybe like a little bit from just kind of like the whole ETF ecosystem. So kind of what you were saying, when the ETFs first launched, it was all just passive funds, low cost indexing. And then I remember I was already around working here at some point, like all the smart beta funds, that was like the hottest thing for probably 2 or 3 years. And everybody had a value tilt and everybody had a, you know, small versus big tilt. And they just got slaughtered because, you know, it was right around the time when all that matters were, you know, I guess FANGs or Mag7, whatever is the latest group of these big tech stocks. And they just drive the market and they're the only winners. And you get this like really weird situation where the market as a whole is up, but, you know, except for these couple tech firms, everybody else is kind of flat. So that was a horrible time to be a smart beta product. And I guess people don't really talk about them as much these days. So for us, it's sort of, I wouldn't say it doesn't matter. So it obviously matters. We care about the S&P 500 and the returns of the S&P 500. And by construction, if it's going to be driven by seven stocks and the seven stocks are up, the S&P 500 is going to be up. But it is a weird situation because it feels like, you know, we're trying to predict this index. And is it really an index when it's supposed to be, you know, diversified index? How diversified is it really when, what is it, like 40% of the S&P 500 are 10 stocks or 9 stocks?
It was like 5, and it was like 45%.
Yeah.
Well, no, yeah, actually, I'm talking about the Qs. The S&P was never that high, but the Qs got to be like 50, didn't it, or 49?
Yeah, and even the S&P 500, I think it's like 30%.
Yeah,
40%.
It's up there.
So it's up there. So, I mean, so I guess then it ends up dictating what the predictors are for us. So like what we've seen is like the valuation. So like all these like aggregate valuations ratios and the fundamentals don't seem to matter as much because you're really not looking at 500 different valuations. All you care about is seven stocks. So then, you know, last few years, what's been driving our models has been a lot of just momentum, a lot of volatility moves, a lot of, you know, market sentiment. So you know, if the situation changes and the market becomes a little more evenly distributed when it comes to components of S&P 500, maybe different indicators that have been underweighted last few years come back.
I mean, yeah, because we have the retail clients, some which we deal with, I mean, you have people that will say, I want to be in the market, but I think those stocks are too high. So if you get a strategy together where you pick out some of the smaller, you know, if you're in the healthcare, you try and dance around those stocks, your last couple of years have not been anywhere near as good, but the client didn't want to be in those stocks. And yet those, thinking they weren't going to do that 2 years in a row, and guess what? They did.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, but it, you want to be in them, and then you don't want to be in them, right? It's a, so you guys, well, tell us all about the your main fund here, which is the which is your main ETF if somebody wanted to buy it today.
Yes. So the ETF, Whole Tactical US, so the ticker symbol is HTUS, and it's an ETF that is going to celebrate its 10-year anniversary in 4 months. So we launched it in June 25th, 2015. There's a very few tactical ETFs, and there are even fewer that have made it to the 10-year mark, and I feel pretty good about us making it to the 10-year mark. And so basically the investment premise is pretty simple. So in aggregate, it's a good idea to be invested in the market. So nobody doubts that. I think if you were not invested in the market for, you know, the last as many years as anybody remembers, it was not a good idea. So if, and we measure these 30, 40 different indicators, and if everything seems normal or on average, we are going to be 100% invested in the market. So we take all the money in the ETF, put it in the S&P 500, and we have a pretty wide array of tools that we can use to be invested in the market. We can buy the SPY ETF or any kind of S&P 500 ETF. We can buy E-mini futures. We can buy SPX options. So, you know, the question on how are we going to be invested in the market, that's a whole second layer of what we do. But generally, every day, we look at these four different indicators and we see, okay, so for example, you know, the volatility moves and the recent market moves are telling us to be bearish, and the interest rates are telling us to be bearish, but maybe some kind of a sentiment indicator is telling us to be bullish, or, you know, right now it's the end of the month, so we know the turn of the month effect exists, so maybe we want to be a little bit of bullish because of that. So we sort of calculate all these contributions of all these different indicators, and depending on what they tell us, we will either go over 100 or under 100. And then in
Petra,
theory...
Petra, not to interrupt, but when you talk about the monthly indicators, I mean, a lot of... I mean, when I started the business, there was no such thing as a 401k. And it really was... It might have been an IRA. I'm not positive, but the when you talk about, you know, the January effect and other things, the end of the month, is some of that just... people are getting their paychecks, and 10% of the paychecks is going to 401k, and there's money dropping on people's desk. I mean, is it the mutual fund buying phenomenon? I mean, there's somewhat of a reason why people invest in the 401k the day they get their paycheck, right? I mean, could it be traced back to that sort of things, or is it other stuff? Do you have any idea?
Yes. So there've been two theories about this effect, and I like one of them better than the other. The one I like less was it had to do with like when and how companies announce good news and bad news. And, you know, the theory was like the companies tend to delay bad news towards the end of the month, and then they announce good news as soon as they hear it. But I don't know if I buy that. So the better theory for these like seasonal moves around the end of the month is the 401k. And even if people didn't have 401k, I'm sure, you know, people get the paycheck, people try to do the smart thing and send a portion of the paycheck away. And it's been largely automated. So, you know, people get paid, people don't even, you know, think about it, just piece of their paycheck goes immediately through a 401k, and then they have some kind of a very simple allocation, and the 401k administrators just basically send and buy more.
Yeah, they don't have any discretion. It just the check lands on their desk and they buy it.
Yep, exactly. So there's no analysis, no thinking. So there's just suddenly new money entering the market, regardless of what has happened, and it's just because it's the end of the month.
Well, when you go to your site here, I'm looking at Hull Tactical Funds. There's a big
hold on, wait a second. But new money or money that's going from the company to the employers?
True, money that's going from the company to the employees.
Okay.
Well, I mean, if you,
I have this debate all the time with people.
But I mean, if you're looking at where is the bottom line on the market, unless mm-hmm. there's something that's driving it down, every day there's money to invest. Correct, Petra? I mean, it's just the way we've set the system up. When I say we, the 401ks and stuff. I mean, I'll be real quick on this because I want to ask you all more about your meter stuff, your bull and bear meter. Mm-hmm. Petra, I used to do a lot of seminars. You know, once in a while I still do some speaking, but I used to do a real lot. And some guy shows up, and the first thing I would do is I'd ask him, why is everybody here? Like, what do you want to learn? And some dude says to me, I understand that you
on an up year last year in the market, in the trading pit, you're a bearish trader. I traded more puts because I stood next to a put guy. That you made money, so I want to learn from you because I am so bearish I can't taste it. And I said, okay. Why do you? I forget who the hell was president. It didn't really matter. He said, you know, the politics is horrible. Everything's horrible. The market's overvalued. I'm so bearish. I said, okay. So what do you have in your portfolio? Do you have an account? Do you have puts? What do you have? Well, that's what I'm here to learn. I said, well, you don't have anything in the market. Well, I've got my 401k. I said, what do you have in there? You're all in cash in there, then, correct? Well, no. Why would I be in cash? That's my pension, or that's my that's going to be my pension. I said, so let me get this straight. You've got 80 or 90% in stocks. Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. I said, in last week, did you get a paycheck? Well, yeah. So in other words, you're here telling me how bearish you are. Not only are you 90% in stocks, you bought some last week. The guy looked at me like I had four heads. Well, that has nothing to do with it. I said, it has everything to do with it. What are you talking about? it is scary how people compartmentalize this stuff. And even people will tell you, Petra, I know you're in the sun, how can I get short? What do you mean short? You got $1 million in stock. Get rid of it. Put it in cash. Well, I'm not going to do that. That's my retirement. And it's really weird how people's mentality is different than their actions. And I think that's what you guys are picking up on a little bit.
Yes, 100%. I think a lot of, you know, why we think the markets are not always efficient, or at least in the short run, is people maximize their individual preferences. It's not this, like, rational, you know, mean variance optimization and profit maximization. It's a lot about, you know, people's fears and, you know, people's, I guess, fears of missing out also, because somebody might be super bearish, but if all of his friends are investing in the S&P 500 and they're telling him at the golf course how they're up 25% last year, I mean, that hurts a lot if you're a contrarian.
Petra, I'm looking at the Hull Tactical Funds, and I would encourage everybody to look at this page. It's pretty interesting. It's the ticker, like you mentioned, HTUS, Primary Exchange, CBOE, and it's got a CUSIP number and all that kind of stuff. And you've got, it looks like you got $80 million involved, right? 81. And I'm looking at the top, there's a market sentiment meter. It doesn't say petrometer, but I imagine this must be your baby. When I knew you were coming on the show, was it yesterday or day before? It was 84 out of a scale up to, say, 170. Was it 170? On a scale of 200. Is that 200?
Could go all the way up to 200.
Right, so today it's 95. Now, What caused you to goose this thing 11 points since yesterday?
So there were a couple. So, for example, yesterday was a down day. So just a very small adjustment. There's always going to be like a little bit of a reversal when it comes to recent market moves. So that has changed a little bit. And then we have seen some like small, and this was like never, or very rarely, it would be just one thing that has changed day to day. But what we have seen a small reversal in the signal that came from interest rate. And because I think we saw yesterday, the 10-year or the 30-year yield drop down to like 4.3. So I think we picked up a little bit of that. And then some of the dispersion in the lows and highs in the market kind of gave us a slightly less bearish signal. So it was a couple of small things, and then we're approaching the end of the month, so I think we're going to, you know, start seeing a little bit of a bullish signal coming from our seasonal model soon.
Petra, how do you, this stuff to me, and I wish I had, you know, the arsenal that you guys have, but this stuff seems so conflicting to me that, I mean, the other day, one of the causes, allegedly, of the big sell-off, was it Friday, it was people's, people's inflationary expectations, whoever does that number, the number came in horrible. So I immediately looked at my screen here and I go, gee, the 10-year and 30-year rates must be up, and yet they're down. I mean, some of the weirdest stuff is happening these days. And how do you guys get, I mean, you would think that if people's inflationary expectations are up, that if you're going to give people money for 10 years from now, you're going to want a higher return, and yet they're down. How do you deal with something like that?
Oh, it's this endless debate. It's like you know how sometimes good news is good news, sometimes good news is bad news, and it's like, what did the market price in? What were the expectations? So what was the surprise versus the actual number? So, I mean, we could agonize forever, and I think that's partially what creates a room for a fund like ours. Because at the end of the day, you could have an 8-hour discussion about what the market should have done. The models will look at what the market did historically, will make a bet, and a lot of times we'll be wrong. It's kind of going back to blackjack, and I think a lot of your listeners are sports fans, so they know, you know, the best baseball team will still only win 60% of their games, and the worst baseball team will hopefully win at least 30, even though the White Sox
may the White Sox right there.
I might have to like adjust my expectations on what the worst baseball team will do. So, you know, it's not for us, it's not about being right every single day in the market and getting every single number right. We just want to be, you know, over time, aggregate small edges, make a bet every day. So we'll adjust the exposure every day. So
what you're saying, I think, is there's a difference between a good bet and a winning bet sometime.
Yes. Yeah, we make bets proportional to what the model has estimated as our historical advantage. We try to stay in the game. We try to, you know, be systematic, and then hopefully over time this adds up and makes our clients happy.
When if you guys get more bearish, I'm not saying you are or you aren't, does that mean you might have some covered calls in there, or some puts, some kind of hedges, or you just lighten up on how much stock you have?
We'll be lightening up for a long time. So in theory, we could go down to 100% short. So, you know, if we produced a short signal, we would actually short some futures and get a short exposure. But for the most part, that would be really, really rare for us. So for the most part, when we get bearish, we'll drop down to, you know, 70% long, 50% long, 40% long. And that will still mostly achieve just by lightening up the exposure.
So you never really go with the, like, Armageddon puts or something like that?
We do have the ability to do so. I don't know what kind of indicators would have to start flashing for us. Historically, it's been pretty risky to actually short the market over the long run.
Oh yeah, wow.
So yeah, so we have the ability to do so, but that would be kind of a pretty rare signal for us.
In terms of growth, obviously you've got a real number here with $81 million. Is that recent? Did it start out? Is it steady growth? Is it what is I mean, what causes you guys to have a good month? I guess is my question.
So the growth has been really recent. So basically, we're almost at the 10-year mark, and probably for the first 9 years, we didn't really talk about the fund very much. It was listed, it was available, people who knew about it, but we kind of wanted to make sure we have all our ducks in a row, we have the performance, we have the strategy. So I think recently, we started talking about the fund a little bit more to people. We went from about 30 million to about 80. You know, so hopefully we're trying to get to the $100 million mark. That's a big milestone for all ETFs. And then the capacity of the fund is huge. So then, you know, hopefully we see a couple more zeros come in.
I'm going to go over here a couple of minutes, Petra, because this is fascinating to me. I mean, if you look at a spider fund, okay, the State Street, there was a specialist somewhere, who does it now. If people started buying the spiders, the guy would sell you the spiders, he'd pick up the S&P 500 stocks, he'd go to State Street, he'd say, here's the stocks, and they'd issue him some spiders. So it was a very simple, it was all held, it was, still is, at State Street Bank. If I decide, you know, I get a client and go, geez, I heard this lady on your show, and she sounded terrific, here's $20 million, put 10 of it in, you know, the Blair Hull Fund, or the Hull Tactical Fund, how does that percolate its way to you? Where is it? Who handles all that?
Oh, so if somebody wants to buy a fund, so all the assets are with a custodian. So if somebody goes to the exchange or goes to one of our authorized participants, so those would be like all the big banks, and say, hey, I want to buy 20 million of the of the whole fund. They basically send the cash to our custodians and they create new shares of HTOS and then send them.
But I would, my client would just go to the, we just go to the exchange today and buy it, right?
It depends how much your client wants to buy. I would say if your client wants to buy more than what the on-screen liquidity is, I would give a call to either us or our lead market maker, that's GTS, and then they can, you know, if you tell them, hey, I want to buy 10,000 shares, they'll tell you to place a bid and they'll, you know, fill your offer immediately. So I would actually make a call to make it less painful because, you know, for smaller funds, sometimes the liquidity is not there. So if you want to buy a larger number of shares, I would work directly with us.
So the guy making a market in HTUS is not ready for a $10 million trade this morning, probably.
You know, you might catch them by surprise, but you know it would. But they're always happy. They're really eager to work with us. Whenever we connected them with a client, we got filled at really good prices really quickly.
Petra, I've enjoyed this more than you know. I mean, I've learned a bunch. I found you delightful. I definitely want to have you back on again. And next time we'll talk a little bit more about why should somebody just invest in it. I mean, a little bit more of that. I mean, today we spent a lot on background and so forth. Greg, do you have anything extra? You got time for a question, bud.
One question. What keeps you up at night?
I would say what keeps me up at night is proving that you can do better than just buy and hold. That's kind of become my life's mission, and I want the fund to be successful, but I also am very passionate about just extending this semi-academic discussion.
Hey, good for you. I mean, next time I'm going to go a little bit further into your bio here, because I found it amazingly impressive. Then you got to the one part that I've got, an MBA from Chicago. All the rest of the stuff I don't have. I'm jealous. What can I say?
Thank you so much, Tom.
Anyway, you take care of yourself, and thank you very much. We'll have you back on, Greg. Thank you for participating. Andrew, nice job.
Thank you,
SP Futures up 24. Hey, Petra, we're down 8 points since we've been talking here. All of a sudden, we're down only up 24. NASDAQ Futures up 125. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Greg. Take care.
That's all, folks.